Originally, I'm from Germany. I was a pastor in East Germany for a couple of years before I came to the United States. What we did in the first two sessions was that in the first session, I looked at our particular situation at the end of the 20th century, a situation which I think is characterized by things being out of balance. We can see that in a variety of fields. Most pressingly, I think, in the field of environmental studies, some of the relations that were fairly in balance between man and nature, and also among human beings themselves, seem to be out of balance. And I proposed in the first session that that might have to do with an identity crisis of humanity. A crisis that makes us worry about who we are and what we are here for. That is a relatively new question in the history of mankind, the way it is asked in the 20th century. And then in the second session, I looked at a variety of ethical models that might help us to find out answers to the question of how should we behave in a situation like that. Today, as a third step, I want to look at our tradition, particularly at the tradition of the concept of creation, and I want to find out with you whether this tradition might help us in this identity crisis of humanity, whether we can learn from our own tradition an answer to the question of who we are and what we are here for. Normally, when we think of the doctrine of creation, we think particularly of the book of Genesis in the Old Testament. What is new in the 20th century inquiry about creation is that we have a discrepancy today between our experience and the biblical witness to creation, or at least we perceive the biblical text as in somewhat conflict with what we experience the world to be. That has to do, I think, with the development of science and the way we look at the world. Science interprets the world completely by ratio, by reason, whereas the biblical texts seem to bring other dimensions into our understanding of reality that are not accessible to science. I quote from one of the very popular books. It's still puzzling me why it was a bestseller for so long in the United States, from Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. I don't know how many of you have read it. I read it. I found it very fascinating, interesting, but also relatively difficult reading, but it was on the bestseller list for many years. I think an indication that people today try to turn to science in order to find an answer to the question who we are. In this book, Stephen Hawking writes, "Our goal is a complete understanding of events which surround us and our existence. If we know an answer to these questions, human reason would triumph at last. We would know God's plan." The goal of science here seems to be to figure out God's plan. Stephen Hawking still uses the word God, but what is intended is that as soon as we figured out God's plan, we would not need God anymore, because the plan would be sufficient in itself. There would be no questions left. That is a development that that took a long time in the history of the human mind. It started, I think, already in the Middle Ages with William Ockham, the so-called Doctor Invincibilis, who could be described as the inventor of empiricism. Some of you who had taken logic classes are familiar with the famous Occam's razor, which basically says in its shortest form, never use more than needed. That's basically what Occam's razor means. Actually, a fairly useful rule that might be helpful in other enterprises and in science. What is meant is never use more presumptions, arguments, explanations than needed for understanding a problem. Don't build up all this kind of explanations that are not needed. Go to the core of things, and if you understand the core, then you don't need any that is more ornament. From that point of view, science became relatively fast and an independent branch of human thinking. Before that, there was no experience of a discrepancy between a scientific understanding of the world and of nature and a theological or religious understanding of nature. Nature before the Middle Ages was simply understood as an expression of the glory of God, as an expression of the glory of the Creator. Now, nature became a place of exploitation, a place which could be understood and could be understood by certain rules that one had to discover. Newton's mechanics then, and I go very briefly here through the stages, developed what I call a mechanical worldview in which it was more important to ask the question, how do things function, rather than the question of why are things there or what is the reason for them. We talked about that briefly yesterday at the discussion about science and its responsibility in regard to the nuclear weapons that were dropped 50 years ago. But today, I think we live in a time when there is some critique of that worldview, when we realize that the question of how do things function is not enough for understanding the world. We need also to ask the question of reason. Why are things there? What is the purpose? What is the goal? There was already a first stage of critique in science itself. Einstein's relativity theory, the black hole theory, and other things questions the ability of science to really black and white like determine how things are and how things are not. Today, I think we are even more in a crisis of science. You can see that that in the science community, more and more the question is raised, can we really want all the things that we are able to do? One big debate is in the field of medical and biomedical science, gene technology, and so on. We seem to understand more and more and better how the world functions, but we seem to lose a feeling of understanding what is good and what is not good. Some people blame the Christian tradition of creation for exactly that development, that we see science as that we see nature as a field that we can explore and exploit as human beings. One of the most prominent persons to critique the Christian understanding of creation is Karl Amery with a book that he calls The End of Providence. And here he claims that the Christian understanding of science proposes four wrong beliefs that we need to put away with if we want to get the world back into the balance that makes life livable. He claims that the Christian doctrine of creation proposes a wrong idea of God by taking God completely out of this world, by making God absolutely transcendent, by separating between God on the one side and the world on the other side. Nature, he says, by that is degraded to a mere space in which humans live. The awe that humans had before in regard to nature is lost, and God is placed outside of nature, and therefore nature becomes godless. It's very interesting that the term environment seems to propose exactly the same thing, because environment basically means the surroundings of man. I would propose that we stop speaking of the environment and would rather speak of convironment, which would mean the things that that human beings live with. I think that would be a healthier way to look at the relation between humans and nature. So not environment, but convironment. Karl Amery then says also that the Christians, the Judeo-Christian tradition of creation proposes a wrong idea of history. History in the Judeo-Christian tradition is a dynamic process and progress rather than a circle. And that means that creation is understood as something of the past, not something that takes place in the here and now. And therefore, even if we link God to creation, we make that link something that happened a long time ago and then almost seems to be disrupted. Some theologians in the 17th and 18th century even proposed that creation was a one-time act, almost building a clock or a watch, and then as soon as the watch is built, there is no need for the watchmaker anymore, but the watch can go by itself. And Amri thinks that led to the way that human beings see nature as godless as well. The third point that Amri makes in his book is that the understanding of sin and justification is problematic in the Judeo-Christian tradition because it overestimates sin and it is very undescriptive in regard to justification. And that means a conclusion out of that overestimation of sin and the undescriptiveness of justification then leads to a work ethics in which human beings are forced to gain their identity by work, which is so powerful, particularly in the U.S. American culture. And a second result of that is that nature is understood as a material for self-realization. And that means I take nature and produce and change and form nature, and that makes me human rather than anything else. And then the fourth one, which is probably the most provocative, the fourth critique is that Karl Amery speaks of an over-excessive ethical demand of Jesus. The radical demand of love is not fulfillable, and therefore it is over-excessive, whereas we would need an ethical program that human beings need law and order in which we can function in the limited way human beings function. Now, all these are quite provocative critique of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and I mention these points before I look into the text of Genesis so that we sharpen our mind when we look at these texts in Genesis 1 and 2 and 3 in order to find out whether this critique is justifiable. It is very prominent in the ecological debate of today to blame the Judeo-Christian tradition for the situation, the technological dominion that we have at the end of the 20th century. What I would like to offer to you is a new look at the text of Genesis 2, 3, and Genesis 1, and the hope that we detect some points in these texts that help us more clearly to find an identity that takes into account these critical points. As you all know, or most of you know, there are two very different texts in regard to the doctrine of creation in the Bible. I'm always puzzled by creationists who say that we have to believe what the Bible says about creation rather than what science says about creation, because my next question then always is, well, which text in the Bible should we believe in, the first, Genesis 1, or the second Genesis 2 and 3. These texts are very different when you look very closely, and I hope that if you take the Bible very seriously, you would want to take a very intense and close look at these texts, and then you will very soon realize that these texts are quite different. And as I said in the first part of the series, for me it is very comforting and encouraging that the Bible offers two very different accounts of creation, because that already shows that there is a balance in the Bible itself in regard of creation. And what I would propose today is that the biblical text itself propose a much more balanced view of creation than the Judeo-Christian tradition utilized in its own tradition. So let's look at the text and try to detect some of these points that might helpful for us finding a new identity as humans. I start with the second story of creation in Genesis 2 and 3, mainly because it is a much older text. It's about 500 years older than the first text. Most people are more familiar with the first text because it is such an impressive poetic text with a seven-day scheme and it is not by accident, because most people think it's a poetic text, it's more a song, and you all remember when you memorize things that you remember songs much easier than prosaic texts. And therefore, I think that's one reason why when we think of creation, we always think about Genesis 1 and much less about Genesis 2 and 3. It's very interesting that the so-called Yahweh story of creation, it's labeled Yahweh story of creation because the writer uses the term Yahweh for God, whereas the writer of the first story of creation, or the first song of creation, uses the term Elohim. The Yahweh story of creation is not so much a story of the creation of the world, but rather of the creation of human beings. That is already the first major distinction between the two texts. And there is a very interesting parallel to other religions. If you look at all different kinds of religion, Native American, Asian religion, African religions, in all contexts, people began to reflect first about the creation of human beings. And it is only a secondary step to reflect on the creation of the rest of the world, of nature. It seems to be that we first have to learn who we are before we can ask the question, what does anything else mean to us? So in all of these stories, the major question, the basic question is, who are human beings? The term creation could be almost said to be coined to describe how human beings came into existence. The question of the origin of human beings does not come out of a theoretical interest, the way we ask questions today, does it work or does it not work, but comes out of the experience of human existence that is threatened. That is the second major point in understanding the creation stories. These are not interestless told stories, but these stories have a great interest in finding out whether there's a way to survive, whether human beings are intended to survive. It's very interesting that in all cultures that speak of creation stories of human beings, there are two elements that are present, almost independent from each other, because we know that there was no way that stories in Southern Africa would influence stories in the Middle East or in Southeast Asia. And these are the two elements that you can find almost universally in the understanding of human beings. The first one is that humans are formed out of clay or out of soil. And the second is that breath is the source of life. That human beings are alive has to do with that they are breathing. Now, I found that very interesting because here again I see a balance. I see the balance that on the one hand, our substance, the material from which we are made, is taken out of a wider context. It's taken out of nature. And that means that we are not distinct from nature, but we are part of it. But at the same time, there's something given to us that enables us to live and thereby be different from nature. The text then in Genesis 2 and 3, and unfortunately I don't have the time to really go deep into the text, but what I found interesting in the Yahweh story is that most Old Testament scholars think that there are two different stories in this text. That's a little confusing my students at the seminary still after a semester-long lecture, sometimes confuse it. So that is a little confusing. The Yahweh story of creation itself contains, again, two different stories. So actually we have three creation stories, two that are contained in the Yahweh story and creation, and then the other in Genesis 1. And the stories can be quite clearly identified as distinctive stories by a couple of points. In the story A, which is the story of the creation of the man and the woman, man is the object. Human beings are not active, but everything happens to them. Whereas in the story B, the story of the garden and the fall, human beings are active subjects. They do things. Not only things happen to them, but they do things. The first story, and what makes it a little difficult to figure out which one is which, is that the Yahwehs, to put this finally into the text form, mix the stories up. So sometimes the story jumps from one to the other. The story A is basically Genesis 2, 4 to 8, and then verse 18 to 24. And story B, the story of the garden, starts in verse 9, and then there are two verses, 16 and 17, and then from 25 on. So the story A, the creation of man and woman, starts with verse 4, in the days that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens, when no plant of the field was yet in the earth, and no herb of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was no man to till the ground. But the mist went up from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground. Then the Lord God formed man of dust from the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. And the Lord God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put man whom he had formed. It's very interesting if you compare the Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and 3 to notice the difference of the evaluation of water. That shows already that the two texts come from very different cultural contexts. In Genesis 1, water is regarded as a threat, as something that is part of the chaos. The ancient ocean is something to be scared of rather than something that is a source of life. Whereas in the second story, in the Yahweh story of creation, rain and water is very important. Rain is one of the most precious commodities that the earth has to offer. And only when there is rain, when there is mist, and when the earth is watered, then the garden is possible to exist. The second thing that is important in this text is that it speaks of nature as a garden. And I think that that is a very helpful way to understand nature as something that needs care, but something that is not completely dependent and controllable from humankind. In the first story, the story of the creation of man and woman, the question is asked why human beings can only be what we are in the community with a you. Some people interpret this text, and even in the New Testament already interpret this text as the text that would make marriage the basic form of human community. I would leave that open, whether the text has this inclination. Certainly there are different forms of marriage available in the time this text was formed and today's concept of marriage. But it is quite clear that the text says that human beings can only be what they are if they have a you opposite to them. They can only find out, they can only understand themselves as an I if they have a you opposite themselves that makes them realize the I. And that's actually a fairly interesting observation that I make as a father, and I know that there are other fathers around. It would be interesting to hear how they observe that the development of a child learning that the child is I, which is a relatively late stage in early childhood. First, children refer to them by their name, because that's what they hear other people call them. And then the ability to realize that I am an I is only a relatively late point, which I think comes out of the experience that there's a you opposite of myself that enables me to be an I. Now, if we would take that seriously, then we would need to come to the conclusion that the concept of individualism that is so present in our culture, that the concept of that I am what I make out of myself, is basically in opposition to this concept of humanity that would say that I can find out who I am only in conversation with a you. Now that modern individualism then comes out of the tradition, as people claim, out of the Judeo-Christian tradition, does not prevent us from going back to our tradition and finding out that maybe we have interpreted these texts wrong when we concluded that individualism is the only way that human beings can find their identity. Now the second text then speaks of the situation of human beings in danger and surrounded by evil. It's very interesting if you look at Genesis 3 particularly to see that there is really no explanation of why there is evil in the text, what you would expect from a text like that, or even some identification of the direction from which evil comes from. The text says in Genesis 3 quite clearly that the serpent that represents some of the threat in verse 1 is a creature of God, as you can see in Genesis 3:1. Now the serpent was more subtle than any other wild creature that God, the Lord, had made. He said to the woman, I don't have to continue, but that the Lord God has made. That's the important thing. In a way, the serpent is as much part of the creature of God. It is not identified as something that is evil more than anything else, but it is part of God's creation. And that means that the text about the seems to indicate a different question that we are called to ask when we deal with the evil, rather than the question, where does evil come from? Obviously, the text doesn't give us help in answering that, and maybe that is a question that we cannot answer as human beings. The text rather proposes a way that human beings should deal and act in relation and in the situation being surrounded by evil. I need to go on because I want to get to Genesis 1 and also would like to give you some chance of questions. Let me pose some conclusions here, and I know that this has been very brief. I think that the question of the second story in the Yahweh story, the question of the fall, is not why does death and evil exist and how did sin come into the world, but what are human beings why are human beings as creatures of God limited by death, suffering, and sin? And the answer that the text tries to give is that it proposes a connection between guilt and death, but that there is something that goes beyond that connection of guilt and death, which is clearly indicated in the fact that the curse that is proposed in the beginning of the story does not work. The expulsion from the garden is quite different from the proposal in the first place that human beings will die when they eat from the fruit. The expulsion from the garden does not mean an absolute separation from God. Human beings still are alive after guilt and evil, and therefore human beings remain God's creature and even under the protection of God. One of the most fascinating parts of that story is that God then clothes the human beings and therefore provides them with help in their realization of being naked. My Old Testament teacher in Germany actually thought that this whole story was written to explain why human beings dress. Although I think that's going a little too far. Human beings, the story wants to propose that human beings have to exist with the conflict to be away from God but still under God's protection. And that is the particular situation in which we find ourselves, what is called East of Eden. John Steinbeck has written this fascinating novel with that title. We are away from God. We experience God as distant. We are not under direct protection of God, but we are still under God's protection, even though we experience God as somebody who is far away. And that means then, for the condition of humanity, I would say three things. One, we live in a situation where we struggle with our destiny. We live in a situation where we have to ask the question who we are. We know about God, but we cannot accept God without any question. We cannot accept God as a constructive and helpful limitation of our humanity. That's what Paul Tillich in this century called estrangement or alienation. Man, he said, is alienated from the foundation of his existence, from the other and from himself. Of course, he uses here sexist language, which comes from the fact that English doesn't have a term, a gender-neutral term for human beings, like other languages have. So human beings are alienated from the foundation of their existence. And that has an impact not only on the way they relate to themselves and they relate to others and God. That was the focus of the theological tradition. I think today we have to add that also has an impact on the way they relate to nature, that they relate to the context, the environment in which we live. Adam in paradise would be the human being in correspondence to God, but the experience of that man in correspondence with God is already an experience of limitations. Secondly, this is a situation which is specifically human. And here I think some of the critique of the Judeo-Christian tradition makes sense. The Judeo-Christian tradition is an anthropocentric tradition, focuses on the identity of human beings more than anything else. Genesis 2 and 3 speaks about human beings with only limited knowledge about the context in which they live. It claims that it belongs to human nature to sin and to strive for reaching over the limits that are set before them. I personally believe that the eating of the fruit was not really the actual sin that was committed in Genesis 2, but the experience that the protective commandment of God was something that was limiting myself rather than protecting myself. That is the core, the root for the sin, because as soon as I experience the protective command as something that limits myself, I want to go beyond that limit, and we experience that with our children. I mean, we of course have all the good intentions to say do not climb this and that, but the children then at a very early age experience it rather as a limitation of their possibilities rather than as a protection. And then third, the reconciliation between God and human beings, the solution of that conflict and the fulfillment of humanity can only happen when human beings begin to realize that God is not enemy or the limit of man's possibilities, but the one who enables human existence. That is the key theological solution that the text proposes to us. As soon as we learn to experience God not as somebody who restricts us to make us less than God, but as somebody who enables us to be who we are, then the reconciliation between God and human beings would be possible. Now let's briefly look at Genesis 1, a very different text, much more sophisticated than the story of Genesis 2 and 3. As I said before, it's a poetic text that you can see already in the repetition. It has a very complex structure, which is very fascinating, and we don't have the time to go into that. If you are interested, I have tables in which that is shown. The text is 500 years younger, people estimate, than Genesis 2 and 3. It has a structure, and it works with a structure, but it has some kind of inconsistencies that are interesting. The structure does not take over the content, but the content is still more important than the structure. For example, Old Testament scholars are puzzled by the fact that we have eight works spread over 6 days. Wouldn't it not be better for the structure of the text to have 6 works and 6 days? That would be much, much more simple. I think when we look at this text, it is very important that time is the first act of creation. If you look at Genesis 1, verse 1 and 2. That is a new understanding of being. I think that makes this text almost modern, and at least it is 500 years younger than the other one. Being in time seems to be more important than being in space, and therefore the creation of time is the first creation that enables then the day and night structure, whereas being in space is only secondary to being in time. The text clearly, and I don't go much into the creation of the world, certainly the text speaks much more about the creation of the world, about the stars, and so on, but let's take a look at the creation of human beings. Here, there is a clear difference to all the other acts of creation by God, and that is that there is first a reflection on the creation of man in Genesis 1:26, whereas in all the other works of creation, God simply says, and it is so. in the creation of human beings, there is some reflection needed. One could interpret that, I've never heard that, at least to give the possibility of a second thought. You know, let's first think about that. Is that a good thing to do or not? But God goes ahead and creates human beings, and here it is said that human beings are created in the image of God. And that is then the most famous point of reference in the understanding of human beings in the Judeo-Christian tradition, that somehow there's a close link in the way God is and human beings are. They are clearly not the same, but they are clearly related so that one can speak of human beings as images of God. But the text still clearly says that human beings are what they are as creatures of God, created in a way that they are under God. But then the text, of course, says and claims that there is almost a hierarchy that goes from God to human beings and then to the rest of creation, to what we would call nature or environment, the so-called rule of dominion, that human beings have rule or dominion over the earth. It's interesting that some scholars believe that the point the text here tries to make is not so much that we have a free ticket to exploit the world as we want, as it may please us, but to make clear that there might be a dominion over animals and over plants, but there should not be a rule of man over other people. Because other people are also created in the image of God, so that the text is really not so much, should really not so much be the base for environmental ethics, but rather for political ethics. Some people also believe that the text proposes that we all should be vegetarians, because killing should not be possible. What is the image of God? Why can we speak of human beings as the image of God? There is a variety of proposals out there what really makes us images of God. Augustine, one of the great theologians of the church, said that the powers of the soul, that we have memory, intellect, and love, these three, make us to be images of God rather than other things. Other people believe that our ability to be religious beings, to have knowledge of God, makes us in that close link between God. And there are some people that even think that our upright walk makes us being in the image of God. And anthropologists, of course, say that that being upright and freeing our hands for productivity is one of the main characteristics of the difference between human beings and animals. I personally think that the image of God does not refer to one particular special quality of human beings, but to the existence of human beings in itself. It refers to the dignity of human beings and therefore proposes that there is a fundamental difference between human beings and the rest of the creation. I move on here and just propose four conclusions, and then we will have still some minutes for some questions and debate, and then I will continue this tomorrow. The conclusions. I think that both of these texts that we very briefly looked at today, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and 3, do not want to make statements about the beginning of the world, but rather of the meaning of the world. And therefore, they can propose an alternative to the way we try to understand we understand creation with the first cause model, that that creation has to be understood what is the cause for things. The text does not necessarily speak simply about the cause of things, but rather about the meaning of things. Why are there things? Second, I think that if we would have looked at the text more closely, we would have realized that both of these texts at the same time utilize certain worldviews, but at the same time critique certain worldviews. Particularly Genesis 1 critiques the idea that stars and moon and sun are divine, but it proposes that all is part of a creative activity of the one God. We could conclude from that Christian speaking of creation does not sanctify a certain worldview. We are able to utilize other worldviews, other concepts of creation that surround us and utilize them for our theological points that we want to make. Third, I think that to call the creation good in front of a world full of suffering, evil, and destruction in these texts, particularly in the text of Genesis 1, is a statement about God's will. So in a way, it does not propose that everything is still okay, but that it is God's will that this world is good. And therefore, it is not only a concept that deals with the past, if you remember one of the critiques of Karl R. Marie, but it is also something that deals with the future, that has an intention in it, and that has a goal in it. I personally, therefore, believe that you cannot really talk about creation without talking about the end of times, without talking about what theologians call eschatology, talking about God's will of the future. The Christian concept of creation is not something that deals only with the past, but deals with the present by raising the question of meaning and deals with the future by raising the question of hope. We can call the world good because it is wanted by God and therefore can be affirmed by us. And that makes the Judeo-Christian tradition quite different from other worldviews. And these worldviews, I think, need to be criticized from a perspective of the Judeo-Christian tradition even today. And these alternatives would be that either the world is godless, that the world is some kind of evil place which we have to leave behind. Unfortunately, this concept was always very strongly present also in the particularly Christian tradition, saying that this life is only part of an enduring process that we need to leave behind, and therefore salvation then means to be liberated from this world, away from this world. Basically a concept that Gnostics have. But also it is an alternative to call the world being away from God. The Judeo-Christian tradition of creation says that the world is linked to God, and therefore there is no need for asceticism, there is no need to withdraw from the world. Both points of view, the one that calls the world as godless or distance from God, does not recognize that the world is a deed of love of God, which can be enjoyed by us. And then the fourth point that I would like to make before I open it up for question, I think that the faith in God the Creator relates to the experience of deliverance. An interesting fact of both texts of creation is that in relation to the core or the center of the Jewish faith, the experience of the Exodus must be regarded as primary to the experience of God as the creative force. That's a big debate, and I can't go really into that, but it's obscured by the way the Bible is then finally put together, that the creation texts are the first thing we read when we open the first page of the Bible. But I think it is quite clear that the primary experience of the people of Israel of God is the experience of the Exodus, the experience of deliverance and liberation, rather than the experience of God as creator. And that means then that whenever we speak of creation, we have to relate our concept of creation to the concept of a God who liberates us from the burdens of humanity that we find ourselves in. I leave it here. We have about 9 minutes left. I'm sorry that I again talked so long, but these are fairly interesting and complicated texts, and I feel that I haven't even scratched the surface of them. It would be fun to do a whole week of just looking at these two texts. But I want to give you some time to react or to pose some questions or to raise some problems. So the floor is open for your comments.
Michael,
go ahead, Jim.
Referring to what you helped to point out as sort of that third creation text in terms of what we normally call the fall narrative, are you familiar with Rosemary Ruther's Gaia and God?
I haven't read it, but I've heard about it.
Yeah, right. Well, it's an interesting book, but one of her most passionate claims in the book is the following, that the connection between sin and death is one of the most ecologically damaging Christian theological constructs.
Mm-hmm.
And what she wants to argue is that sin needs to be reserved for those activities which human beings do, which defile, destroy that fundamental relationship that we have with each other, that I and thou, that I and you, which you emphasize so well. And that death, at least within the context of the natural life and ecological reality, needs to be a part of creation and not linked with the natural finitude, not be linked to our sinfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And her argument is that because Christianity historically has made the relationship of sin and death, that has contributed over centuries to a sort of earth-fleeing ethic, earth-denying ethic.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that sort of claim and its relationship to Genesis?
Well, if you look at Genesis 3, first you would have to say that death is really not the punishment for sin. That's the first point. The punishment is the expulsion. The punishment is the impact on the relationship, that we are not close, but we are somehow alienated. We are not, Genesis 3 says the impact of whatever happened is that we are at a place where God is not, this east of Eden. So in a way, there are some people debating even, claiming that the serpent was right and God was wrong in the text, because God had said you would die if you eat the fruit, and they didn't die, so the serpent was right, not God. I think also you have to take into account the way the Judeo tradition sees death. The fact that there is almost no concept of resurrection or eternal life in the Old Testament, the idea that there is a good death, that when you are 70 years old, it is not something negative, that your life is going to end. And I think that we can relate to that experience if you have if you know people that are of that age that really think that it is almost a relief to know that that we are going to die. I don't know if you know by Jonathan Swift that story in Gulliver's Travels. Most people know only the two places where he travels to to Lilliput and to the giants. But there's also a journey to a place where from time to time somebody is born who cannot die. And there's a great mourning in the community when that person is born. And Gulliver is surprised, because he says, well, all the rest of humanity thinks that is the highest goal that we could have. And they said, well, think about it. Think about if we would not be able to have closure, to have an end, what would that mean for our life? So all these leads me to say that we have to think about death more and differently than our tradition, particularly the New Testament tradition, has done. And I think there's even in the New Testament the concept of two different deaths. That death is not necessarily the ceasing of biological functions, but that death could be understood as something that is that makes us unrelated, and therefore there's a possibility to overcome death without proposing necessarily a biological solution of endless life. So I think that there are hints in even in our tradition that would make us very cautious to make that link between sin and death the way it was done. And I see that even in the text of Genesis 2 and 3. Go ahead.
I'm always fascinated by the second tree
yes.
in the garden.
Yes.
And the way in which it, for me, it seems to raise this issue, which I think you touched on. You said something about reconciliation. When humans recognize that God is an enabler of us, and that in that wonderful poetic way, we had two choices. We could have chosen the tree of life,
mm-hmm.
but we chose the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Instead, we emulated God. We tried to be like God, and we couldn't quite make it. We couldn't make it. It was too much for us.
Uh-huh.
But he had offered us this other ongoing way, if you take it in that sense, of life in more of a union with him, more of a harmony with him.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what would have happened if they'd eaten of that tree as an allegory for our condition? And it's a tree that doesn't get much press, it doesn't get much attention, and yet it's where we come back to at the end of things, at the end of what he has done for us.
Actually, that's you raise an interesting point in regard to the text. For some of you, that might be interesting to read the text again and to find these two trees. There's a big debate about the two trees, and it really doesn't make a lot of sense because one part of the story seemed to propose only one tree in the middle of the garden, and the other part of the story then speaks of the tree quite differently. So I don't know if we can really can speak of a concept that there are two trees and that the fall was only a one-step fall. You know, the damage could have been worse, but it's certainly an intriguing idea. I think again that, you know, during the Enlightenment time in the 17th and 18th century, people proposed that it was actually not a fall that happened in the paradise, but it was an important step in the development of humankind. There's this famous one-liner that in German it rhymes: die Welt mit ihren Mängeln ist besser als ein Reich von willenlosen Engeln. You can roughly translate that the world with all its faults is better than a place where there would be only angels without will. So in a way they say that, they propose that eating from the, of course here the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, was an important step in becoming human. That would be another interesting debate. Was the fall necessary? Was the fall actually indeed part of the creation story that is told by God? Because certainly the possibility of the fall is included in the story of the garden. But that could be a lengthy debate.